All right, welcome to the Recruiter Startup Podcast. I'm joined here with Boris Epstein from Bink. How are you today, sir?
Doing well. Great to be here. It's bright, beautiful morning.
All right. So I'm pretending to be in Gary Vee's office here, as you can see, from my backdrop. And you don't have much of a backdrop, but you're in a beautiful part of the world.
Beautiful part of the world. This is a nice accent wall here in my home office slash work studio.
You're and you're north south of Santa Barbara, just probably 40 minutes north of LA. Is that right?
Yeah. Los Angeles. For those not from Los Angeles, little over the hill of LA proper, San Fernando Valley area. What is that?
How long have you been in the recruiter before?
We'll be going on our 19th year this year. That's a number of years we've been running my business. I had a whopping 1 year of recruiting experience before starting.
Wow. Walk me through it. How did you fall into the industry?
By complete accident, like most people fall into recruiting. I needed a job. A friend of mine was working at a recruiting firm. They were hiring. He got me an interview, told me a little bit about the work that they do, made no sense to me, but sounded great. Went in, got the job, got an offer on the spot, accepted on the spot, was trained in half a day to do agency style recruiting, and then hit the database to start from A, and then started calling candidates to find my first NPC. And then that NPC was supposed to be our ticket to go find new clients, and away we went.
The ball goes rolling. Very good. What gave you the confidence to go out on your own after such a short period of time?
That's a good question. It's probably naive confidence, but I come from a family of entrepreneurs. So despite 1 year feeling like not a long time of experience, I was getting family pressure after my third month working at the company. But over the course of the year, kind of rewinding back, we were a small contingency shop that primarily relied on job boards to identify the talent, and then job ads to identify hiring companies. I found that to be an overly competitive space because that's what all the recruiters were doing. So I had the bright idea to pick a niche, a specific set of companies and specific set of candidates, and go out and find companies that weren't posting and find candidates that weren't active on the boards, and use that as a way to differentiate from the competition.
Which niche did you go for?
That's a good question. So I started recruiting just past the dot-com bubble being burst, just past September 11th. And so, and we were a more technology-focused agency. And so traditional software or technology-related jobs weren't hiring. So I stumbled upon a niche of civil engineering, land development. There's this whole industry of companies and talent, transportation engineers, traffic engineers, geotechnical engineers, wastewater engineers. This was 2002. So imagine all the buildup to the 2006, 2007, 2008 real estate boom. We were recruiting on the kind of earlier end of that. That was the niche.
You had the great run up of it.
It was fun. Yeah, it was great. And they were short on talent because all the great talent went to the tech companies during the dot-com bust. And so it made for a great place for a recruiter to play.
At what stage did you change your model?
So I worked at this company for a year, left to start Bink. Bink had two main goals. One was to offer a distinguished recruiting service to our clients. Again, we wanted to always stand out from our competition. So we focused on a super specific niche within the software industry. And then the second thing was to offer an elevated recruiting experience for the people that we employ. We thought that one of the problems in the market was a super kind of wide range of quality because there's no real barrier to entry for a recruiter to get into the space. We know if you have a phone or a computer, you could be a recruiter. And so we wanted to elevate the bar a little bit. And so always innovated on culture and employment related experience. So we ran ourselves a very standard contingency recruiting service for 7 years. Okay. So for 7 years, we did, you know, classic thing, put our buildings on the board, you know, rang the gong when we made a hire, you know, did the dance, you know, and when we made a hire, very, very traditional agency style stuff. And then 7 years into our experience, I took on a business partner. He came from very similar background to myself, but from the in-house side. He was a recruiting leader coming out of Microsoft and Bridgewater, huge hedge fund. And we came together, compared notes on, you know, what worked in our respective, recruiting models and what didn't work. And then we put together what we refer to as a hybrid. And then off we went to kind of part two of our journey.
I'm just guessing timelines here. Did the global financial crash, did that give you a chance to reset and reassess everything? Is that when the business partner came in?
That's exactly when, early to mid 2009 was when we were conceptualizing all of this.
Great idea from out of tough times.
Yeah, the market. Yeah. So, tough times make for great innovation opportunities. But yeah, the market was going down. We didn't see contingency as a great way to service the companies that needed to hire in our space. And so we conceptualized a way to help ensure that they get their hires within the time that they actually needed them. And that's when we conceptualized more of a hybrid model, more kind of classically defined as RPO.
And in terms of that, you were going to drive the sales side and he was going to drive the other side. Is that the initial plan?
No, we both did everything. So at that point in time, we were small. Our first hybrid project was just, you know, him and I, working on the inside of a client. They needed to hire, 12 people in a 4 month period. And so we were doing all the recruiting, and conceptualizing the growth model, while doing all the work.
So you went on an extreme growth journey, really over a 10 year period. When did you get to a stage where you were like, oh, this is working now? I need to kind of manage myself out of some of the day to day.
That's a good question. So from when Bruce and I started, working inside the client, we were a 2-person firm. We pretty quickly grew to 20 people. While still working on projects, running the business, in the evenings, we knew at that point we needed to invest in operations and, you know, people who could help, you know, support and run our business. I've always had a very active hand in some part of recruiting delivery, whether it was business development or whether it was managing our clients and projects, up until probably like four or five years ago, I stepped fully into a CEO role. And that was when our company was, I don't know, say 60, 75, maybe 60, 50, 60 people. I don't know, something like in that range. And I took on more of a classic CEO role from like, 50, 60 to the biggest we've ever been was at the beginning of last year, right before COVID. We're at 157 people.
That's
pretty crazy.
I'll probably go into it in a bit, but I can imagine when COVID hit, you're looking at your operating costs and thinking, this juggernaut's got out of control. What? How can we fix this? What was it like? What was that like for you?
Yeah, COVID was. You know, so I started recruiting after 9/11, worked through the banking crisis in 08. COVID was the gnarliest and the fastest of them all. It just felt like a bloodbath. The month of March, in the early parts of April, we were getting client cancellations on the daily.
Yeah.
And business developments completely fruitless. So a bottom for us was when we had heard a data point of there being 30% recruiter unemployment in our market. And we were in the business of, providing the market with recruiters. So there wasn't there wasn't much business for us. We had to let go a bunch of people. We had to furlough a bunch of people. We were, doing what we can to, add whatever value we could to the companies that were working with us during that time. And some companies were, doubling down. And so it was a very kind of stark contrast. You could remember back to like a year ago, the market was slipping and sliding, but there were some companies that found themselves on the positive side of the COVID economy. Everyone that services your stay-at-home world, right? And they're like, hard time to double down. And so we found ourselves both unfortunate to be working with companies that were, not needing our help, and then super fortunate in that some companies were choosing to double down and wanted more of us. But from a business leadership perspective, I'll tell you, before COVID, we used to do company meetings, 150 people distributed throughout the country. Everyone, has a slightly different connection to our company. We would only meet quarterly as a whole company. So that just kind of gave you a sense of like how status quo people kind of got used to our company being. When COVID hit, we switched to a weekly meeting cycle, and that wasn't fast enough, just because the world was changing so fast. People needed the up-to-date information as immediately as possible.
How are you finding it now with clients? Has your recruiting process changed, given that there's not as much face-to-face interaction? How has that affected the RPO world?
Yeah, so we recruit for the technology industry. So think of look at your phone, and look at like the main apps you use. Those are probably our clients. So we work with companies that a lot of them are based out of the Bay Area. A lot of them now are super distributed in terms of location. But yeah, mostly Bay Area, a little bit of New York, a little bit of LA, a little bit of Seattle, a little bit of Boston. Wherever the tech hubs are is where we would commonly work. So from the side of like remote culture, I feel really fortunate in that our market was really quick to adapt to being productive working from home. You compare us to like the physical industry of like hotels or live entertainment or restaurants, and I mean, I just feel super blessed that our industry was able to so quickly adapt. There was from mid-March to like June, there was a lot of wait and see. A lot of the kind of leaders in our space, venture capitalists, kind of like the big influencers, were compelling a lot of the slow down in hiring, the pause in hiring, thinking that this pandemic may be longer lived.
I listen avidly to Jason Calacanis's This Week in Startups. He holds multiple venture capital funds, and it was just he was really, at that time he was like, everybody's on hold, you need to wait and see. And then
A lot of in our industry there's a lot of groupthink. And so one venture capital says, stop hiring, fire everyone who you don't need, cut deeper than you even think you need to cut, plan on this for 18 months. That was what the influencer herd was saying, in April. Come early July, we saw a big spike in market demand. It's like the market decided that they've waited enough. It's time to start hiring again. And then one after another, they started to pick back up their hiring. So the herd, Jason Calacanis and many of his peers, changed their tune. And so over the course of the back half of the year, from last July 1st until the end of the year, we experienced what was probably the most aggressive run up in hiring demand that we have ever seen in my 19 years of business. So it was like March crash, and then a very aggressive V shape up to what is now. I mean, you look at the public markets. Technology companies are trading at crazy valuations, and you have crazy run up in all sorts of technology companies, and that connects back to privately held companies, SPACs going going public, raising money at inflated valuations, and all of that connects back to an accelerated need to hire. And so we went from 30% recruiter unemployment 8 months ago, 7 months ago, to inflated hiring, a demand where these companies can't get near enough, and a recruiter shortage. So
that's insane.
That's my last 6 months. Yeah,
those are tough over here in the UK, and in Europe in general. I know there's certain areas where there's a bit more of a pickup, but I have a leadership community of hundreds of recruitment founders, and we're definitely in two speeds of a global economy, tech and life. Tech and
I think K, people talk about the letter-shaped recoveries. I think K is probably the most accurate, where some segment of the world is experiencing a big uptick in return and opportunity, and then a big segment is very much down in the dumps and struggling, and probably hard to see a light at the end of the tunnel still. So it's probably the best parallel I've seen is both the Roaring Twenties and the Great Depression happening at the same time. Probably like the best comparison I've been able to see.
So the news is full of people leaving California. My YouTube feed, because I want to move to California, is telling me I shouldn't. telling me that all your tech clients are moving their HQ to Austin, that they're distributing their workforce throughout the country. I suppose my question is, how does that affect an RPO model like yourself, where traditionally you would have put somebody on site? Now that that's no longer a requirement, can you pool resources? Does it make you more efficient? Does it lower your cost of hiring for your own business because the location isn't as central anymore? Or are your clients saying, well, okay, it's work from home, but or HQ's in Austin, I want somebody in Austin, or maybe I just want somebody in the Texas region?
That's a good question. Basically what happened, so when everyone started working remote, companies very initially wanted people to be as local to their headquarters as possible. One after another, companies in the tech space, again, there's a lot of herd groupthink in our space. So as major companies started to announce an openness for their employees to work anywhere in the country, that started to become a lot more of a kind of standard in our space. So it's very common for a company that's based in the Bay Area to say, we are open to employing people anywhere in the country. Now, some companies are changing their headquarters. I can't honestly tell you what that means. There's certainly not a physical move of headquarters. It's possible that it's anywhere from, a paperwork change, all the way to perhaps the, changing of headquarter to a small local satellite in a different city. For example, I can't give an example.
The biggest one is obviously Elon Musk moving to Austin.
Yeah, and in that example, I think Oracle also has officially changed their headquarters to Austin as well. I can't say for certain, but I'm near certain that Oracle didn't move their headquarters, like physical headquarters, to Austin. I'm most certain that they have a satellite office in Austin that has been relabeled the headquarters, with the openness for their employees to continue living and working in California as they like, and also openness for their employees to live in and work anywhere in the country. My guess is that's the same for Austin, for Tesla, I'm sorry. Maybe over time they'll swing a little more of their employee base over to that state, but for now
it's a tax credit.
Headquarters is more of a kind of paper-based shift. I think in the future.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think in the future, as we kind of find our way working out of the pandemic, I think employees will crave more in-person work. I think it'll be really hard for companies to shift from you could work anywhere you want to like you must work here locally. I think what companies will end up doing is supporting multiple work hubs throughout the country, with one of them being kind of Coinda headquarters for, you know, whatever reason they kind of choose to do.
Out of the last recession, you sat down and got a new co-founder and fleshed out your idea. I'm sure this time it was a time for you to pause as well and work out, like, what's the strategy for the next period of growth of your company, and maybe, like, change some technologies that you're using or some processes. What have been the big changes for you as a leader of, is it almost a 100-person company?
We're about a 100-person company. We're going through a hiring burst right now. So, you know, whereas we stayed a little flat towards the end of last year, just, you know, creating a little more sustainability at our company, we've greenlit a hiring spree. So we're actively actively growing right now. But the biggest learnings for us was less about service model. We haven't made or are compelled to make any sort of a service model shift. We like the service model that we have. It fits really well with the space. We basically talk about ourselves being in the business of dedicated, flexible recruiting, and that philosophy and that service model only fits even more given the dynamic nature of companies hiring needs. So again, we're really happy with our position. We're really happy with continuing in this regard. A couple changes on just the efficiency of running a business front. So we've invested in technology. We've invested in productivity based technology to help our team and our recruiters be more productive in their respective work. We continue to invest in culture, just from a place of an employment experience, and then we're doubling, triple, quadrupling down on diversity and inclusion. All of our clients, all the companies in the technology industry, at least that we connect with, care about not only building great teams but building diverse teams. We have a philosophy that basically says all great future recruiters will be great diversity and inclusion recruiters. So whether you're focusing on, in our case, like technology, or even other recruiters who focus on life sciences or hospitality or whatever, the building of diverse teams will be of equal importance to building a team in general. And so we're doubling down on that.
I'm terrible at diversity on this podcast. Everybody like you. it's really hard. It's really hard to find recruitment founders that aren't white men between 30 and 60. It's and I do reach out to people, and I don't know. It seems to be the overlying demographic, perhaps. I don't know if that was company's hiring policy 20 years ago or on that, but
it could definitely be. I think probably in the recruitment space, maybe a little bit of gender balance. But I think like with any diversity, problem or opportunity, start with awareness, and then take steps to influence that. On the podcast side, it'd be taking proactive steps to identify and invite, and one at a time, and start to see some of those demographics shift. That's certainly what we tell companies. Companies will talk about caring about diversity and wanting to build diversity into their teams, and we'll start with an understanding of what diversity currently looks like for them, what they want it to look like. We're super data driven. In our approach, and so we could track the effectiveness of what we're doing for our clients, and then over time, diversity and inclusion is a journey. We've been on it for many years, and over time you make progress, but you still kind of always feel like there's a lot more work to do because there is.
And with regards to finding excellence in your own team, because your guys aren't 360. It probably makes it a little bit easier because you're not trying to teach them sales.
That's right. They would be considered, our team would be considered more candidate side full life cycle. Our company takes responsibility for finding the client, setting the client up with partnership with us, and then we embed the recruiter. Recruiter then is responsible for doing full life cycle against that given set of reps.
And how do you determine what's an excellent recruiter whenever you're bringing them into your company?
That's a good question. I'd say if there's one thing we've developed a nice expertise in, it's the hiring, developing, and kind of, you know, grooming of great recruiters. We look for a couple of things. For us, our values are super super important, so that we know when we bring people in, they're like-minded from a values perspective. Values like respect for one another. We culture is like, you know, team mentality and mindset, grit to be able to kind of work through tough challenges, have fun. So, you know, bring, you know, keep it kind of like light. So values is super important. Aptitude. So like potential is super important. We look for people who are smart. Smart people are able to, you know, understand complex concepts. They're able to think on the spot, problem solve, invoke confidence from, you know, people who are usually impressive from a client and candidate side. We look for people who are determined, persistent, all those kind of recruiter qualities. Given that recruiting is a business of failure, you know, we make one hire out of every, you know, 20 people that we introduce to our clients. And so that means a recruiter has to feel comfortable failing 19 times in order to succeed that one time. And then the third one is passion, right? Someone that can bring some sense of authenticity or like spark, basically, to their interactions with their clients, so that they stand out. And then them standing out makes them a kind of desirable person to be in connection with. Those are like not the values and aptitude are like non-negotiable. So we could hire someone that has no recruiting experience with values and aptitude, and we can train them and develop them into a recruiter. If someone happens to have recruiting experience, then we'll vet them on skills. So we'll vet them on the types of clients that they've serviced, the type of roles that they've serviced, whether they've been in-house or agency, what their productivity and metrics have been, what their basic training and kind of recruiting kind of approaches to sourcing, recruiting and client side items. And then we'll kind of align them basically to where we think they are along the like capability curve. And then that's where they get started, and then they kind of grow and develop from there.
Okay. All right, Boris. Well, look, that is us for today. Thank you so much for your time. I've really enjoyed getting to know it, getting a taste of that Californian life again that we yearn so much. One last question. If you could do it all over again, what would you do differently?
That is a great question. I mean, I'm personally really happy with how we did it. It's, you know, certainly wasn't perfect, but it was a great story and great ride. If there was one thing that I could do different, I would invest in technology and productivity efficiency earlier in our curve. And I also probably invest earlier in the inclusion work that we only started doing about 4 years ago, way earlier as well.
All right. Interesting. Yeah. All right. Thanks so much.
Yeah, great being here. Thank you for